Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. We're here again in Salt Lake City for another great episode. I'm kind of jumping the gun to say great. I mean, I really should say mediocre, you know.
We know it's going to be great. It's always great. Every night's a great episode.
Thanks. In the ask his position, is Randy. Well, or do you want me to call you Randy? I can't remember.
Whatever. Just take your pick. It doesn't matter. But yes, I am taking that seat tonight. It is, if it's not labeled, it's going to be after tonight. This is officially the ass kissing position.
Welcome. Thanks for coming. And making her star debut is Wendy. Hi, Wendy.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Thanks for coming on. Wendy faithfully replied when I said Mormon Expression needs more women, and you stepped up to the plate. Thank you.
Yeah, it's pretty hellish being here right now.
Now you've been out of the church a long time.
I have been, well, 20 years.
Yeah.
But I just barely resigned about 3 months ago.
So did you read your scriptures getting ready for tonight?
I did, and
you still
it was
have
awful.
Scriptures?
Yeah, I don't have scriptures. I had to look it up online. I mean, I have them somewhere, but I couldn't find them. So yeah, I couldn't believe how hard it was to read the scriptures again. Really took a lot of getting into.
Well, now, but you served a mission, right? So you had
I
them
did.
Memorized.
I at one time had them memorized, but all the primary songs are the only thing that's remained. I can pretty much sing any hymn still, all the verses, but the scriptures
I went to a funeral and it was a sad funeral, but I was singing the hymns, and it felt so natural, and it felt so great. And I mean, it was all bullshit, but it was just fun to sing. That's the thing I miss more than anything is to be able to sing. Cause the only way I can sing otherwise is to get drunk and go to karaoke, and you don't want to have anything to do with that, when I'm doing that.
I agree. I miss the hymn singing.
Yeah. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you.
And David, this is also your first
Hello.
Time.
Hello. Yes.
What brought you here tonight?
Well, I saw that you were a panelist short, and I said I'm available, and this is my first time here. But I've been a listener for a little while. Kind of like Wendy, I've been out of the church for about 20 years as far as attendance and believing, but a couple years ago, I found out how easy it is to email your resignation letter. Used the technology to make it official.
Yeah, we need to cover the lawsuits that made that possible. It used to not be available to you. They would tell you you had to be excommunicated, but now it's just an email way. You know, I sent a letter in because it says that you have to talk to the bishop, and I said, I'm thinking about leaving the church. Have the bishop call me. And then later, just a letter showed up and said, see you later. We don't want anything to do with you.
We're good.
Obviously, John, you're so notorious that they knew what they were dealing with, or they just Googled your name and said, who's this guy that's requesting to meet with us?
I don't think they know who I am, actually. I went to conference, like the priesthood session a while back, because we were doing the conference review. Do you know how many people are in one stake center? It's just mind-boggling, the number of people still in the church. Their numbers are overwhelming.
They really are.
All right, so we start the podcast now with the news segment, This Week in Review, in News Review. So I've got two stories of things that happened this week. First of all, there's something in business called signaling, which is you can't collude directly with your competition. You can't price fix. So if you want to price fix, I'll tell you how to do this with your competition. What you do is you drop the price way, way below cost. And you leave it there for like a day or two, and then you set it to the new price. And what you're telling your competitors is, if you don't follow along with the price fix, then what we're going to do is we're going to undercut you. So that's called signaling. And the FCC or whoever, the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, they watch for that. So what will happen is there'll be a huge price drop. There'll be a price level set, and then you'll watch everybody sets their price at the same level. It's like watching Breaking Bad and learning how to launder money. I'm telling you, I'm giving you. So the church does things where they signal, and they sent out this week the First Presidency urges political participation in the state of Utah. Funny how that goes, where they say, hey, go participate in the caucuses. And I was listening to the news today, and they talked about how whenever the church does that, there's a measurable increase in the number of people who come out who don't otherwise vote. So it's one of the ways the church influences the political scene. Like we mentioned a few weeks ago in the podcast where the church came out with their thing saying, no, the alcohol laws are just fine, just fine. And then the spokesman for that gave the opening prayer at the legislative session 3 days later. Same sort of thing. I mean, the signal was loud and clear, right? That the church tells the legislatures what they want and then...
No, John, that's not possible. They would never meddle in politics that way, especially not through such an obviously subversive method.
Well, they used to do it. They used to do it up more up front. And it's really actually kind of sad that the control is so strong that the legislatures will just, if the church signal or just even, they get a feeling the church wants something. They'll all vote that way, right? Because they want to appear in line. And of course, the caucus, we don't want to go into that, but it's part of the problem in the state of Utah. And I read this also as an endorsement, because that's been up in debate. And because the church specifically says go participate in the caucuses, I read that also as a church endorsement of this government system, which allows for a minority to sort of control, the political process, because everybody doesn't really have a vote. You just have a few lunatics, really, who are controlling the system. So that's always interesting to watch the church maneuvering.
Interesting, you mean like watching a car wreck as you drive by?
The second big story, and the story is partly the story. Channel 2, one of the local news outlets here, actually ran a story about a talk given by Tad, what's his
Callister.
Name? Callister. And he's a 70, right? Was this at BYU Idaho?
Yeah, this was, and then they reprinted it in the Ensign.
Okay. Here's a message to the church in 2014. You can't hide out in Idaho anymore because, like, all the weird shit's coming out of, like, BYU Idaho these days, right? Because they forget, because they're up there in Rexburg and it's in the middle of fucking nowhere, and they forget that the internet is available everywhere. So they get up there and they say all this crazy shit and they forget that it's going to hit the news media. And so there's a lot of discussion about rape culture. Rape culture is a real thing. And I'm not an expert in feminism, but basically rape culture says that you have a culture that it doesn't necessarily say go out and rape people, but it'll say things like, if you do X, Y, and Z, then you're going to get raped. That you, victim, are responsible for the actions. And it goes one step beyond, because in the church, when they pay lip service to this, they talk about thought crimes, that you are responsible for the thoughts of other people, and you're responsible for their actions. And the subtext of that is, if you, young lady who's baring her shoulders like a strumpet, if you are out there and this guy can't control his thoughts, then he can't control his actions either. That you're responsible for what becomes you. You're going to get what you deserve. And this talk almost, if I didn't know better, you would think it was a parody. It's Poe's Law right there. It's flat out rape culture. Because they blame young women, say you're responsible for the thoughts of men. Now, this is extremely negative towards women and puts them in a position that's ridiculous, first of all. But I don't mean to be the whiny man, but these guys hate men too. I mean, the subtext is like men are animals who can't control themselves. And if you show the guy a shoulder, he's going to like whip it out right there and go at it. Like he can't even stop. Oh my God. And this is true. Look, okay. Well, I got a secret for everybody out there. Men and women are sexually attracted to one another. And unless, well, they're different. Okay.
Wait. Is there a biology lesson in this? Because I don't know if you should be giving that.
It's like a Star Trek episode.
That you can't stop this train. Okay. Like if you do something different, then people will be attracted to whatever that is. Most of what, if you took a list and wrote down what makes somebody a strumpetus. Strumpet. that's culturally dependent, right? It's not universal. Which means that these things are learned. which means you can't stop the system. Because if you have, what's that hairdo they all wear down in Colorado City?
It's not the foof.
Yeah,
the purple.
I grew up in the 80s. That's when you take your hair, your bangs, and you tease them straight up in the air, and then have them hook over. That's the Utah claw. I haven't seen that in years. Not since Flock of Seagulls. If you have the women wear calico dresses and bonnets, the men will start getting boners looking at the bonnets because they're attracted to the opposite sex. And you can't stop that. It's knock it off.
There's an association between the bonnet and the woman, and it doesn't matter what you connect it with.
Right.
And coincidentally, you know, Northern European dress styles are what we find modest here in Utah, right? So if the pioneers coming from, you know, Northern Europe dress for that weather.
Wait, in Northern Europe, they wear those denim, like, jumpers? Is that?
Well, there may have been some variation over time.
Do women still wear the denim jumpers to church? Is that still a thing?
Well, like, if they would have come from the South Pacific, predominantly here in Utah, they probably would have been... What would be considered modest today might be quite different.
Right, right. If this
worked, then women in burkas would never be sexually assaulted. I mean, of course, that's one of the highest sexual assault rates.
Pakistan's the number one.
Places. And if they're getting sexually assaulted and they're completely covered, then obviously this modesty thing isn't working.
Well, and what really bothers me is perversion of the term modesty, right? Mormons do not understand what the word modest means. Because they think it means bearing skin, and modesty has nothing to do with that per se. It's a term that's been stolen. But I think the real story here is
for those in the listening audience, he's pulling out his wallet.
All he got is a five.
All he's got is a five. We'll that's all right. That only buys you like a bonus of one at this point. So,
all right. So that's the news for this week. Welcome to it. Okay, so our topic this time, we have a two-part series. Tonight we're talking about hell. And tomorrow or next week we'll be talking about heaven.
I see that you invited me to the hell one. I think there's an underlying message there.
Well, I'm bringing a panel of my sister wives for the heaven one. So
that's probably a good idea.
Not that there's not an opening. I don't have a quorum yet.
Is that an invitation, John?
Yeah, it could be if you play your cards right. All right. So hell. I have said before that there is nothing in the church doctrine that they haven't fucked with, that they haven't changed at some point. I still have thrown the gauntlet down for somebody to give me a single doctrine, any doctrine, that hasn't changed. But one of them that has changed considerably and very visibly is the doctrine of hell, in Mormon theology. So we're going to start at the beginning. We're going to start in the Book of Mormon. Because the Book of Mormon is obsessed with hell. And it's obsessed with hell in a very, 19th century, New England-y way. Surprisingly enough. So first of all, let's be clear. The Book of Mormon is supposed to take place 600 BC, right? And people are always talking about smoking guns. Well, there's one right there. The hell was not really, it's not even really in the Bible, to be honest with you. It appears sort of late scripture and in, references that are sort of out of time. It's completely anachronistic for 600 BC. And the concept of hell that we have now was very much influenced by the Greeks and the Greek concept of the underworld. And that the Greek concept of the underworld appears in the Book of Mormon is de facto proof that the Book of Mormon is not what it says it is. This is one of those things where Mormons are at a huge disadvantage because they haven't been paying attention to the dialogue that everybody else has been in for 2,000 years. And they are ignorant of their own ignorance. Not that Mormons are dumb people, but they've been shielded from this narrative, and they have this weird backwoodsy 19th century interpretation of the Bible that they keep running with, that when anybody else encounters it, they scratch their head and say, what the fuck are you talking about? Because people would know that this concept of hell that appears in the Book of Mormon is not from this time period at all. And it's just really strange being in there. Unless you figure out the book was written in the 19th century, then it's not as weird. So the Book of Mormon portrays a very dark concept of hell, a very traditional concept. Now, if you want people to do things, be they children or be they adults or be they employees, you need to either reward them or punish them, and usually both at the same time. And if you really want people to do very important things, you want to amp those rewards and those punishments up, right? Because if I really want you to do something for me, I'm going to give you everything or take everything away from you. And that's basically what the concept of hell is. You take the very worst possible thing you can imagine and say, if you don't do these things, then that's what's going to happen to you. And if you buy into the concept, then you're buying the concept that the very worst, most rotten thing can happen. The problem I have with the concept of hell is it logically doesn't make any sense to me. I'll be honest with you. I can't follow it because there seems to be a paradox of hell, which is no matter what you do in this life, it's finite, right? There's no sense of eternal ramification. Now, we'll talk about that in a minute. But it's finite. As a matter of fact, you and I all know men in particular who are big assholes when they were 25. Then the testosterone kind of levels off a little bit. And 20 years later, they're really just sort of mellow dudes. And you really want to know them. But they were big dicks when they were 25. That's 20 years, right? And 40 years, 60 years in human lifespan can make a huge difference in what people are. But what we're saying when we talk about hell is that you can do some actions that'll be finite, but they'll have infinite punishment. They'll have infinite results. And the doctrine that's presented in the Book of Mormon of hell makes very clear that this is an infinite state, that it's eternal punishment. Now, Joseph Smith plays loose with the word eternal here in a little bit, but So you have this double-headed paradox. First, there's such a thing as eternity if it exists. An infinite punishment makes no sense at all for a finite activity. It can't. In terms of justice, just mathematically, it can't. Because the concept of eternity is it's just mind-blowing. Like if you hear somebody serve a 50-year sentence, like imagine a million-year sentence, but then you do a billion of those, and then after you do a billion million-year sentences, you do another billion of those, and then you do another billion of those, and you're not even scratching the surface, right? You haven't even begun to do anything, and so likewise, if you have a finite atonement, which would have to be finite. There is no sense of an infinite return for that. That doesn't make any sense also. Because you're trading this minuscule thing for this huge eternal return. And that is the problem that I fundamentally have with hell.
So I would like to add, I think the problem that I have with the concept of this infinite hell is usually there's some sort of, you know, torture or whatever involved with it. Given a long enough time, I don't think that torture is going to be torture to you anymore. It's just going to be, I get up on a Tuesday morning, I get whipped, I get tossed in a, you know, puddle of fire, and I go to bed and get up the next day and do it all over again.
You would go insane, right? The system would have to be maintained, right? I have jokingly said before, I don't believe in God for God's own benefit, because if God exists, this guy is a fucking asshole of the greatest degree. And to create something like this that exists in perpetuity, forever and ever and ever, that's some weird Shit, man.
And even if someone was a truly evil person during their 70-year lifespan here on Earth, I mean, there's probably a reason, right? They might have some, you know, genetic problem, or they were abused, or, you know, there's a reason some people are different than others.
Well, sociologically, when we look at prison populations, there are huge predictors. IQ is a predictor, broken families, propensity for like substance abuse. There's these things that we're finding more and more have genetic components. So you kind of have to buy into this idea that God sort of wanted you to go to hell. The Calvinists embraced right out that they just said, yeah, fuck it, man. You're either going or you're not going. It's nothing that you're doing here. Which in a lot of ways makes more sense. But now I want to point out in the Book of Mormon, I want to point out the violence of language in the Book of Mormon. So I'm just looking down the index here. Thrust down to hell. Thrust down to hell. Loathes people carefully into hell. Devil says no hell. Blah, blah, blah. So there's this language where not chains of hell appear several times. It's not just that you're going to go to hell, we're sorry, but the whole action of putting somebody in a hell box is one of verbal violence, the way they express it in the Book of Mormon.
They say, like, grasp you with his awful chains and leadeth you down to hell. All kinds of dramatic language like that.
Yes, fire and punishment and abominations and very Dante-esque, this whole book. Now, what I love about the Book of Mormon is if you took somebody, you took a Nephite, and you brought him into Salt Lake City, like, they would have no idea what the Mormon Church is talking about today. And with that, let's go to Doctrine and Covenants, Section 76, because the Book of Mormon really reflects Joseph Smith's time. And to heck with the, to heck with.
You take a dollar out for that. This is progress.
The Book of Mormon, ignore all the anachronistic stuff. It's just doctrinally, it has nothing to do with Mormonism, right? All the things that Joseph Smith came up with in the Nauvoo period and later are completely absent. And I know we've done podcasts on that before, talking about all the doctrines that should be in the Book of Mormon, that they wouldn't recognize the plan of salvation. They wouldn't recognize temple work. They wouldn't recognize the anti-Trinity. What do we call it? Is there a clever term for the Godhead? Thank you. Wow, I'm starting to slip. So all that stuff would be completely foreign to them. So Joseph Smith introduces the Book of Mormon in 1830, of course, and it, once again, it has a very Protestant theme, and the writings that come after that, like Lectures on Faith, they're very mainstream Protestant. And you don't see the attacks coming against Mormonism in the early period being for their unique doctrine. Although they do say, oh, you come in and you settle all these doctrinal questions that are really relevant to the time. And, you know, one I use commonly as an example is baptism for the remission of sins. This was a really important idea in the 19th century. No one gave a rip about it before, and no one gives a rip about it now. But it was this window of time when it was like the cool thing to argue about. And lo and behold, here it is in the Book of Mormon from Mesoamerica. But anyway, so Doctrine and Covenants, Section 76. This is... Joseph Smith starts going through the Bible with Sidney Rigdon in 1832, or 1831, 1832. And he starts using this as a riffing point for coming up with a lot more doctrinal innovation. And they do their translation of the Bible, and they start getting these ideas. Now, there are some ideas of... I think there's a scripture in the New Testament, I'm not a New Testament scholar, that says that, I can't remember, who was taken up to the third heaven. And I've read what it means, and the scholars argue about it, but the Bible is full of all these little, like, weird things that if you want to start a fundamentalist religion, what you do is you riff on one of those things. You find one of those little weird things, and then you have the ascended masters come tell you what it means, and bam, you've got some followers. Sex and fun follow. So that's what you want to do, is start a religion based on those little things. So Joseph Smith starts breaking this down. And what I found ironic as a Mormon is that we would make fun of the Christians because they only had two heavens. The heaven and a hell. which obviously was not nearly a complex enough system to account for the diversity of human experience. So we're going to give you three.
Well, three is more than two, John.
Three is more than two.
I mean, obviously. Plus, it's really like, it's kind of like 3.5, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point, but.
Well, we've subdivided the top one into three, right?
Yeah. So. Well, we turned heaven into three heavens, and we still hold hell, but it, as I imagine we're going to explore, is not quite recognizable as hell any longer.
Right. So let's review the plan of salvation. We all existed infinite time ago as spirits, intelligence. And then at some point, Heavenly Father spiritually impregnated Heavenly Mother, and we were born as spirits. And then at some point, we needed to come down and get a body. And for a lot of us, the majority, probably, of the population, we were fortunate enough to die of malaria or dysentery or something when we were 4 or 5 years old, and bang, you got a free ticket in. Because that's the way it works. Like, you didn't really have to do anything down here. You just had to be born. And then if you died, you made it, right? The ones that God hates, he let us survive into adulthood and past puberty, so that we had to be tempted. And that most of us would not make it. So for afterwards, we fall into the traditional Christian paradise versus spirit prison.
Spirit prison, yes.
And my seminary teachers told me that that was because the Christians didn't have the further light and knowledge. That's as far as they ever got in the system. So the reason that the traditional Christians only believed in hell and heaven was because they only knew about the first phase.
Well, of course, God didn't, you know, give all of the information to them right up front. You know, it's like a multi-level marketing scheme. You don't really know what's going on behind the curtain until you start moving up and start getting picked.
Right, indeed. So if you are bad, or if you never receive the gospel, you go to spirit prison. And if you're good, you go to paradise, but only for a short time to get a mission call. And then you go down to spirit prison to preach the gospel. Now, I don't know about you guys, but if I wake up after I'm dead and like some missionaries come down, I'm probably going to buy whatever they're selling. You know, I don't.
Yeah. Is that the only gospel preached? Because if there's no alternative or competing things, it's kind of a rigged system.
It seems like an easy sell at that point. I mean, I'm not seeing why you wouldn't be like, all right, sign me up.
But they told me in seminary that it would be harder to convert afterwards. Did you guys hear that?
I heard that.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have these bodily temptations. It's like you don't have to give up coffee because there is no coffee.
See, but they told me in seminary that the hell part would be you would be wanting coffee, but you couldn't actually get any coffee.
Exactly.
Yes, I remember that as well.
I understand better than they do now, but I don't think that would.
So coffee stains your spirit.
It does stain
your body.
It does stain your spirit.
It takes some pretty hefty spiritual bleach to get those stains out, John.
So imagine, if you will, let's do a thought exercise. You die and you wake up on the other side and there's a lot of people wearing very, very strange clothing. And you find out that God's one true prophet was born like in Indonesia, but he died like 7,000 years ago and the world has completely lost this religion. But no worry, in another 1,000 years, he's going to be reincarnated and going to re-put the religion back on the world. You'd be like, what the fuck? That doesn't make any sense. I can't be held responsible for that. That's what Mormons believe, right? They believe that the world went into apostasy following the death of Peter, and that there were these elements that I was taught that before Jesus was born, there had been an apostasy, and there had been these prophets and then apostasy and prophet and then apostasy and over again. And this was a continual cycle, let alone all those poor saps in Asia who they didn't get any at all. So you've got this system where you're coming before the judgment bar, and everybody who's not heard the gospel, which is most of the population, right, is going into this spiritual prison place. No? Am I off base?
Yeah, that's what I learned. And, you know, on the other hand, if I'm in paradise and I have to go back on a mission, I think that's that's another form of hell right there. I wake up with a bad dream, you know, like thinking that I'm back on my mission, so.
That'd actually be kind of a hard sell to convince me that I had actually died and was waking up somewhere, if that's really what was waiting for me, because I have that dream enough now.
I have that dream.
So this place is holding till the millennium. So if you die right now, you're going to go to paradise or you're going to go to spirit prison until the righteous, if it's in your patriarchal blessing, that you'll get resurrected in the morning of the, what's the phrase? In the morning of the morning of the first resurrection, because you don't want to wait. You want to get that shit done quick because you've only got all eternity to kill.
I'm in a hurry, John. I'm in a hurry. I need to get to doing whatever it is you do for all eternity. Cause I don't know. Cause apparently that's another thing they teach in seminaries. You can't grasp how long all of eternity is. So no, whatever it is, I assume it'll just.
It's
going to be temple work, right? You're going to wake up and have 1,000 years of temple work to do.
Yeah.
If that doesn't appeal to you, you're not going to be in the morning of the first resurrection.
This is why they can't shorten the film. They worked it out beforehand that when you add it up, it's 3 hours and 22 minutes, and if they took 10 minutes out of that film by not saying the bear like six times, then they'd have to shorten the millennium to 844 years. You just made it clear.
It's coming together. Yeah.
That's not an even number.
All right,
that makes a lot of sense.
The plan
actually.
Of salvation is not as bad as I thought.
No, it's not. Not nearly as bad as you thought. So that's the first judgment. And then there's going to be a second judgment. And the second judgment happens during the millennium and then afterwards. If you're really bad, you get in the back of the line. And that's when we find our final Mormon heaven, our Mormon salvation or lack thereof. And it's broken down into four areas. We're going to focus on three of them tonight. First one is the celestial kingdom. That's next week. The next one is the terrestrial kingdom. Terrestrial actually means something. So it's interesting. I think there's BYU scholars who try to put some sort of meaning into it, but terrestrial, of course, means earthly. And then there's the celestial kingdom, which was a made-up word by Joseph Smith. It has no meaning. It sounds like it's Greek, right? Telios or something, but no. And then there's outer darkness. And we're going to start with outer darkness because that's where all you are going. It's actually not clear who's going to outer darkness. The Doctrine and Covenants, section 76 starts by defining the devil as perdition. It gives the devil another name. His name is not only Lucifer, he's perdition. So the phrase is the sons of perdition, which leads a lot of people to theorize in Mormonism that only men can become sons of perdition. Only men can go to outer darkness. And I've heard it variously proposed that you have to have had the priesthood, or that you have to have been a general authority, or all this kind of stuff. You have to have had the endowment, but it's not very clear. It's never defined.
And I would, going back through my memory to when I went to seminary, and I don't know if there's anywhere in the doctrine that justifies this, but my understanding of going to outer darkness is basically Jesus has to walk right in front of you and say, you know, what's up? I'm Jesus. This is all real. And you still have to say, no. I don't believe it. Screw this.
Doctrine and Covenants 76, verse 31 says this. And I just look at these verses and I get sleepy.
I do too.
There's coffee in the corner.
It's decaf. God needs a copywriter. All right. Thus saith the Lord concerning all those who know my power and have been made partakers thereof and suffered themselves through the power of the devil to be overcome and to deny the truth and defy my power. They are they who are the sons of perdition, of whom I say that it hath been better that they were never born. So that's what the Doctrine and Covenants said. They have to know God's power partaken of it and basically deny it. And one of the definitions that I hear oftentimes in Mormonism is that the difference between people who go to the celestial kingdom and people who go to outer darkness are people who go to outer darkness, know that the church is true, but fight against it anyway. They fight against it because it's true. So they're perverse by nature. They're like the devil. They want to destroy it knowing that it's true. Mm. And where...
So by the time you don't believe it anymore, you no longer fit the profile.
You're out.
Yeah. Of the son of perdition because you're fighting against something you believe is false.
Potentially. yeah, so... But you might just be fooling yourself. Because he does say, have suffered themselves through the power of the devil to be overcome.
Yeah, the devil made me do it. Yeah. But isn't that my out when I get to that point?
But you allowed yourself to be overcome.
Wait, when did I consent to that? Because I don't seem to recall that moment.
Okay, so verse 34, concerning whom I have said there is no forgiveness in this world nor in the world to come, having denied the Holy Spirit, after having received it and having denied the only begotten Son of the Father, having crucified him unto themselves and put him to an open shame. Now, I want you to know what religion does to people's minds. These scriptures I bought, I think, when I was 16. Those verses that I just read are marked. No, I'm holding my scriptures up. This is something, and I'm not a dumb person. This is something that I was concerned about. We've been making fun of this shit, but we took it seriously, right?
Oh, very seriously.
Not only was I trying to be the best Mormon I could, but I had actual fear that I could be tortured for all eternity.
I spoke about the endowment before, and one of the things that upset me the most about the endowment is... One of the things that upset me the most about the endowment is after I get out of the temple, having no idea what I was about to experience, then I get out of the temple, and now I'm responsible for everything that you're mentioning. It's like, oh my gosh, now I'm on the hook for this stuff. Before, I could deny it, or I could pretend, or I could make a mistake. But now, I'm either perfect or a son of perdition. And by the way, you didn't tell me that 3 hours ago when I walked into the temple. It was such a feeling of I was taken advantage of.
Yeah, it's a feeling of being out of control, that there's a system you suddenly walked into that you can't necessarily respond to. Go ahead.
So I don't know how many of you went through the temple ceremony before when they had the penalties where you had to basically disembowel yourself and slit your own throat. So you get that added to it if you went through it at that point. It seems to me that the whole idea of being a son of perdition seems to be a pretty unclear concept in Mormonism. But when I was on my mission, somebody had a tape of a talk by Cleon Skousen where he talked about it. And it was basically the idea was that, that your spirit would decompose, or your spirit would disintegrate, and you would just kind of explode into space. And there was the possibility that some other god would scoop you up, and so there was always that chance that you could come back and try it again. But don't count on it. It was pretty unlikely. And so that's really the only thing. Nobody really talks about what happens to you.
Well, they talk a little bit about it in verse 44. But you're right, in principle. So verse 44, wherefore he, meaning God, saves everybody except the sons of perdition. Okay, he saves all except them. They shall go into everlasting punishment, which is endless punishment, which is eternal punishment. Are we clear? Because Joseph Smith redefines the word eternal here in a little bit. To reign with the devil and his angels in eternity. That's the fourth reference to eternity.
Reigning doesn't sound too bad.
Wherefore the worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched, which is their torment, that's torment, And the end thereof, neither the place thereof, nor their torment, no man knows. Neither was it revealed, neither is it, neither will be revealed unto men, except those whom are made partakers of. Nevertheless, I, Lord, short by vision unto many, but straightway shut it up again. So it's so bad that God won't even let people see it. The fire never dies. The worm never dies. And it's eternal and it's endless and it's torture.
That sounds pretty bad.
Yeah. I forgot about that scripture. But, you know, again, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, is it figurative? Is it literal? And anyway, it just always seemed unclear to me.
Well, I think a figurative interpretation of religion is sort of the last refuge of a dying faith. These guys didn't take this stuff figuratively, right? And even Sons of Perdition, you can find the early apostles, guys who claim to have seen Jesus Christ, who were selected by Joseph himself, talk about like low-level members of the church who had been baptized and were a member of the church for a year. They would refer to them as Sons of Perdition. So the early people who were there when this stuff was coming out, they didn't have a very high threshold for defining Sons of Perdition. Now, the funny thing is, there's a whole bunch of scriptures I just skipped over talking about how these people would be very last to be resurrected. But what's the point? If you're just going to be floating around in space, you know, like in gravity for all eternity, it's like having a body, not having a body, who the hell cares? What's the point, you know?
Well, isn't though you need to have a body so you can theoretically feel the physical torment? I don't know if that's in here or not, but that seems to be something that I would remember if we go back to my seminary days. I believe that was the explanation why they need to be resurrected is because a spirit can't feel pain, so you've got to have a physical body so that you can actually be tormented for all eternity.
Well, so Satan and his hosts, you know, from the war in heaven wouldn't have bodies to be tormented. Only us that went through this second estate would.
Okay, so to get to outer darkness, you have to have seen the power of God, denied it, and then you get thrown out. It's the ultimate punishment. And I think most Mormon scholars would agree it's reserved for the few. It's not a lot of people. Although one-third the host of heaven's going there, so fuck those guys. So our next level up, if you're not in the celestial, outer darkness, you get to make it to the celestial kingdom. And now we get to meet the TK Smoothies right here in the celestial kingdom. This is a thing in Mormonism, because if you are not in the celestial kingdom, you don't get to play nasty.
Oh, you get a,
you know, because look, if you're,
you get a Ken doll bump.
The celestial kingdom people are all married, right? So they don't get how you have like fabulous Greek orgies for the rest of it. You know, when they show all that Greek stuff in those temple movies and stuff, it's a lie because it's monogamy up there all the way out. And so what would happen with all these celestial people, right? Well, they're going to get bored after a while, right? And no, they're Ken dolls and Barbie dolls and they're not allowed to bump and grind.
Well, and you said it was monogamy in the celestial kingdom, and it's not. It's polygamy. So yeah, I believe, not that great for us.
Look,
women.
On an eternal time scale.
What's the difference?
20 wives, one wife. It's all the same.
So you're telling me those earlier flirtations about having an opening in your harem, you didn't mean those?
It's still not an infinite harem, right? You got to put everything on an infinite time scale.
This is, I'm asking that question of selfish motivation, not doctrinal.
Anyway, what's God doing? Like he's not just like making spiritual babies all the time. He's like creating outer darknesses and punishing people and like releasing AIDS on the world and stuff. Like that shit doesn't take care of itself. All right. So let's skip ahead to verse 81. And we see the glory of the celestial. Now, what Mormons will tell you oftentimes is there is no such thing as Mormon hell. They say outer darkness, that's a little secret thing for fallen prophets. And everything else, the celestial, the terrestrial, and the celestial are all heavenly. Because in the scriptures here, it talks about they all get resurrected and they all ultimately get forgiven by God through the atonement of Jesus Christ. So everyone sort of has their sins taken care of. It's just you're forever locked into this kingdom. And we know that Bruce R. McConkie said that inner kingdom travel was a heresy. And it does not happen. That when you get assigned to the celestial kingdom, you are in the celestial kingdom for all eternity. For a fucking long time.
No, there's none of that going on. We just talked about that. It's just right. A long time, John.
Okay, so now this is, it's important that this is part of the canon, because there's discrepancy here. So in verse 82, these are they who received not the gospel of Jesus Christ, neither the testimony of Jesus. These are they who deny not the Holy Spirit. They are those who are thrust down to hell. So by 1832, Joseph Smith has redefined hell to be the celestial kingdom. Even though in the Book of Mormon it's full of chains and hellfire and abominations and all that kind of stuff, now he's easing off. But that verse 82 is extremely important. They are they who receive not the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because by in 1832, the idea of the temple had not yet been invented. And so they'd followed sort of a Calvinist view here that if you did not have the good fortune of being born into the church, you were going to the celestial kingdom. It's right there in the Doctrine and Covenants. Of course, later Joseph Smith comes up with more innovation, and has to kind of eat these words. But the Doctrine and Covenants is really screwy that way. It's just full of contradiction, and most Mormons don't pick it up, probably because of the weird Shakespearean prose or whatever.
I think this is almost a remnant of the transition in Joseph's line of thinking at the time, because this is kind of this life is it, your only opportunity. It's talked about all over in the Book of Mormon, where, you know, this is the time of your probation, this is the time to find God and everything. This, I think, section is really kind of telling, because this seems to be, I don't know, I'm a biologist, so to use the term, this is the transition fossil of the different doctrines as far as hell and this Calvinist view of this life is all you've got versus this salvation and temple work and everything else that's going to come later. So that's really, I think it's interesting here, because you see a little bit of both in this section.
Right. Absolutely. So 86, again, he repeats himself. These are they who received not of his fullness in the eternal world, but of the Holy Spirit through the ministry of the terrestrial. Okay, so let's talk about the dynamics of these kingdoms a little bit. There is a Godhead, and the Godhead sort of makes sense a little bit in Mormonism when you look at the kingdoms, because the Holy Ghost reigns over the terrestrial kingdom, and Jesus reigns over the Holy Ghost reigns over the celestial kingdom. The Holy Ghost is the bottom feeder. The terrestrial is Jesus's, and God is in the celestial kingdom. So the terrestrial people cannot bear God, but they can, apparently, Jesus is okay. So you have these eternal realms of administration. Now, what they'll be doing there 7,344,722 years from now, in terms of administration, heaven only knows. But they'll be doing this for an eternity. So that's the celestial kingdom. They were the liars, the cheaters, the thieves, the whores, the whoremongers, the, what do we call people who patronize whores? Men?
Johns.
Johns. The Johns. Yes.
They walked right into that one. It seems to would make more sense to be the people who rejected the gospel would be in the celestial. And whereas the people who never received the gospel, well, you can't count that against them, so it seems like they should be in the terrestrial.
One might think. So let's use that as a segue to the terrestrial, which is the middle one. And this is the one that's sort of weird in Mormonism, because you tend in religion like binaries. You want good and bad and black and white and all that kind of stuff. So then we wedge this terrestrial, and I'm going to skip back to verse 71, because in this section, they go celestial, terrestrial, telestial. Verse 72, behold, these are they who died without the law, and also they who are the spirits of men kept in prison, who the Son visited and preached the gospel unto them, that they might be judged according to men in the flesh. So what Dante talks about in the Inferno, and of course the Mormons believe, is that after Jesus Christ was resurrected, that Jesus Christ descended down into spirit prison, and because everybody was in spirit prison before that, asterisk to our previous, and then Jesus takes all the good ones out with him. And these are the terrestrial people. Okay? You might say that that just contradicted what we read about the celestial. Well, it kind of does. All right. Who received not the testimony of Jesus in their flesh, but afterwards received it. They are they who are honorable men of the earth, but who are blinded by the craftiness of men. So these are people, once again, in contradiction to the concept of temple work, who would have been in the gospel had they been born into the church. They will go to the terrestrial kingdom. So the celestial kingdom is the people who receive not the gospel of Christ, assuming either in the world or outside the world. The next ones who would have received it had they been given and then receive it in the second world, they're going to the middle heaven. There's not a concept of the, well, the TK smoothies applies to the terrestrial world too, right?
Well, yeah, because you can't be populating worlds without number if you're not in the right kingdom.
Right. So, they have the same punishment. They're eternally single. They're not allowed to pair bond. And they just sort of chill out for all eternity.
They just hang out.
So the difference, amenities are nicer. So
if the towels are there, if you get resurrected, I mean, this is a really good point, which is everybody in the celestial and the terrestrial kingdom has been resurrected. They both have bodies.
Of a sort.
What's the point of resurrection if you don't get to keep your junk? Like, what, I mean, like, oh yeah, I get a spleen. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of having a body, isn't it? Am I missing something? Like, what else?
You're turning into an evolutionary biologist all the time. You gotta quit talking to me so much.
So the body, anyway, you can't try to make too much sense of this stuff. So it does say that the terrestrial kingdom is just tons better. And they just say, just trust us on this. It's tons better than the celestial kingdom. Because in the terrestrial kingdom, you're in the terrestrial kingdom.
Well, it's like the difference between going to an all-you-can-eat buffet in, you know, Wendover versus Las Vegas. It's better stuff, you know?
I can see that. Now, if you talk to most Mormons and you get them drunk,
good luck with that.
That's actually my favorite pastime, by the way.
I think that most Mormons will tell you that what they're striving for is to make it to the terrestrial kingdom and not the celestial kingdom. Most of them, to be honest, either think the celestial kingdom sounds miserable, or more likely they think, that ain't me. I'm not doing it. Because the church teaches people that they're so corrupt, and they're so sinful, and that, just like they say in Fast and Testimony meeting, if it wasn't for the church, they'd be out raping everything that was walking around, that this is what they're aiming for. It's really a sad commentary on how Mormons view themselves.
A minute ago, you talked about the binary nature of religions, and
this is another binary problem. You either make it to the celestial kingdom where everything is available to you and everything's wonderful, or you don't. Moreover, if your family doesn't make it to the celestial kingdom, then what's the point, right? So if everybody shoots for second best and everybody ends up at the terrestrial kingdom, we all win because we're all there with our families, and it's much easier to do. So let's all shoot for the terrestrial kingdom. Wink.
Well, this is an important point, and one that's hard for people outside the church to fathom. When an individual leaves the church, it causes a huge disruption in the family, because the goal of Mormon heaven is families are forever. That the difference between being a TK smoothie and being in the celestial kingdom is this sense of family, this sense of belonging. When you leave the church, you resign all your loved ones to hell. And there's no way around that, because you're denying them what heaven is aimed at. And I know we're skipping ahead to next week, but it is such an act of theological terrorism to leave the church, that people who would not try to hurt you are still going to be so hurt by that action that they will be unable to interact with you normally for the rest of their lives. That your family relationships will be so strained because what everybody has been aiming for, which is to not be in this terrestrial-telestial state, has been destroyed by you. Which to me is the monkey works of all of Mormonism. They talk about free will all the time, but then they cut the devil loose and allow him to go around deceiving everybody. They allow you to interfere with somebody else's salvation because you're sealed to that person and then you cheat on your temple covenants or whatever. So you're denying this eternal salvation to your spouse. You're denying your mother and father their eternal family because you leave that. There's so much of what is dependent upon everybody else around you to get the Mormon reward, which is why it's so culty, which is why it's such a sticky glue. Because breaking that system breaks everybody's heart. And you can find all sorts of people who will tell, and then bars in Salt Lake, who will tell you that they can't leave the church because they don't want to break their mother's heart. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. And it's evolved that way on purpose. It's not by mistake that the cost of leaving is so high. Because everything we've read and we've sort of joked about, that people, you won't find very many people say, you know, I really want to leave the church, but I just don't want to go to the celestial kingdom. I've never heard anybody say that ever. Like, but it's always about these externalities that happen here in life.
I wonder if some people do the math and say, well, if the goal is really to hang out with your family, maybe you have better odds in the terrestrial kingdom or one of the lower kingdoms. Because if you make it to the celestial and you become a god of your own galaxy or universe, you might not even see your family for, except at, you know, Thanksgiving or whatever.
Well, now, I was always told they could visit, right? There were visiting hours. The celestial people could come down and say, hey.
But if you're so spaced out in the celestial kingdom, you know, universes apart, even at the speed of light, you'd have trouble visiting, hanging out with each other. Whereas in the terrestrial, you could just hang out in the same, you know, compound.
You know what? I think I figured it out. There's times when things get really shitty here on Earth. That's when God is visiting his brother Kevin, who's in like the previous telestial kingdom. No, this is making sense now.
The Dark Ages make a lot more sense in that context.
Right, he comes back and, oh, the mess again. I can't step out for even a little bit.
These damn humans, I can't walk away for 10 minutes. Can't even go change a kid's diaper. Look at what happens.
All right, so we talk about the Book of Mormon being really bitterly vindictive. And then 76 is not really very nice. 88, let's look at section 88 for a little bit. This came not long after 76, so I don't know exactly what's going through Joseph's mind. But if we skip all the way to verse 37, it seems that the irony of saying, hey, a binary system is not complicated enough, so we're going to be a ternary system, struck him. Because in verse 37 he said, and there are many kingdoms, for there is no space in which there is no kingdom, and there is no kingdom in which there is no space. I like, that's sort of a Deepak Chopra thing, you know, you go both ways and then it blows your mind. All right. So, let's read verse 21 through 24. You all have your scriptures, right? And they are they who are not sanctified through the law which I have given unto you, even the law of Christ, must inherit another kingdom, even that of the terrestrial kingdom or that of the telestial kingdom. For he who is not able to abide the law of the celestial kingdom cannot abide a celestial glory. And he who cannot abide the law of the terrestrial kingdom cannot abide a terrestrial glory, and he who cannot abide the law of a celestial kingdom cannot abide a celestial glory. Therefore, he is not able to meet the kingdom of glory. So in 76, Joseph is framing it out as a punishment for an action, for not having a disposition. That's what he basically says. If you have the disposition that you would accept the gospel, terrestrial. You don't have the disposition to accept the gospel, telestial. Now he's saying kind of the same thing, but in a nicer way. He's saying you can't abide this particular law, which begs the question, It's very Calvinist to me, again. It's very Anabaptist. You are sort of destined for what you're going to be destined for, because if you can't abide the kingdom, you're going to go wherever it suits you best.
Yeah, it really comes down to, it's like you are deeply flawed on a personal level. You cannot meet this law. You cannot meet this requirement. There's no way you can possibly do it. It almost, and wasn't it Greek society that where we get the original gold, silver, bronze medals because they believed you actually had a nugget of that metal in your skull, and that's why you were part of the upper class or you were part of the middle class.
Philosopher kings are the top, the gold.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is almost, it's that repackaged in another way. It's just you are not capable of actually meeting the standards of this thing, so yeah, we're going to put you somewhere else.
I remember people saying that one of the humane things about this system is you're not going to be disappointed if you don't like, you know, Mormon Tabernacle Choir music and endless church meetings, then you're probably going to be happier in the terrestrial. So everybody will just kind of, you know, glom on to what they're like, and makes it kind of humane.
Well, and my dad always said, God already knows where you're going to end up. You're only here on earth so that you'll know and that you'll be satisfied with where you end up. But because you wouldn't believe God if he just said, well, you're a telestial kind of person, so, you know, we don't need to go through this whole earth thing because I already know where you're going to end up.
Well, God, being omniscient, knew that before he created you. So once again, he's a son of a bitch for creating a being that he knew would end up. Let's talk about the slag of the eternities, shall we? So this system that we have here of somebody being an intelligence going through earthly life, receiving exaltation, having celestial sex, having a lot of little intelligent babies who then go through their own thing. And by accounts of looking around the world and reading this passage, this is not a broad number of people who make it to the celestial kingdom. It's a small minority. And some people go as far as to say the 144,000 spoken of in the book of Revelation is because that's all that will make it. Of the billions of people, there's only a few select who can make it. And so we go through this pattern where there's been easily 70, 80 billion people. Well, even if you cut back to 6,000 years, you're talking 20, 30 billion the people been on this planet. Of only a tiny minority of those will have any chance of getting a celestial kingdom. So then this gets repeated, and you have near infinite growth because of, let's say there's 1,000 people who make it. Well, they're each going to have 50 billion babies. And then they're going to do that again, and they're going to do that again every 7,000 years, right? They're going to repeat that cycle for all eternity. And so you have this colossal exponential growth of intelligent beings, of beings that are self-aware in the universe. And fast forward, who knows how long this has been going on? It's been going on since, fast forward multi-umpteen billion gazillion years. And it's staggering that this fucked up system is just creating consciousness to lock away into these two little shitholes for all eternity. And that's the purpose, right? If you have a high school that has 1,000 students, of which one graduates and goes on, and everybody else just goes and works at the mines, I hate to tell you, the point of your high school is to put people in the mines. You can't say, hey, it's the one honor student who goes to Pepperdine or whatever. No, you're creating miners. And if you've got this system that's just creating souls crammed into these corners of darkness, forever wiped clean of their one precious thing. You have to come to the studio to see my gestures.
TK Smoothie Miner for eternity.
This is really bad. I mean, this whole thing is wrong. It's wrong to believe. This is cruel. This is awful. This is nothing good about this. The only thing that makes it is a narcissism of eternal proportions, because the only way this makes sense is that your joy in life is had in reflection by what others do not have. The only type of people this would really appeal to, now there's sort of a brainwashing that goes on, are people who really enjoy their tuna fish sandwich only when no one else has a tuna fish sandwich. Because that's what this reward system is about. Because how could anybody go on and perpetuate the system? Because that's what Mormons believe. They will become gods. And they will do the same perverted sick shit again and again and again and again. And most of their children will end up in these little holding cells for all eternity. Every god out there doesn't off themselves because they're that's the only way out. They would want to celestially kill themselves. This is the most fucked up thing I've ever heard of in my life.
What about the folklore where people believe that some prophet said it's been attributed to Joseph Smith that the telestial is so amazing that if we saw it, we would kill ourselves to get there. And that's the lowest kingdom.
Yeah, it might have been Joseph. I don't know. I'm sure somebody out there can look it up. It's at least entered into the lore, right? Go ahead.
So, you know, hearing all of this, you know, what occurs to me is that, you know, this type of system explains why so many Mormons and so many fundamentalist religious people are so attracted to free market fundamentalism and right wing politics and social Darwinism, because it's kind of it's the same thing, you know, this supposed meritocracy. Oh, the people who are good, they're going to end up on top, and the people who are lazy, the people who are stupid, the people who don't want to try hard are going to end up on the bottom. I don't know what you have to say about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's implicit. There, not to go to horrific examples, but this is a horrific thing, talking about the burning people with worms and stuff for all eternity. There was a woman, I wish I could recall her name, about 20 years ago, off the Shiloh Hotel here, who took and threw her four kids off the hotel balcony because they were under the age of 8. And she knew that if she killed them all, they would make it into the celestial kingdom. Tell me the flaw in her logic.
In this system, there is no flaw.
It was an ultimate act of self-sacrifice,
yeah.
Right?
She's sending herself essentially to a lower kingdom, but these kids will make it.
Yeah.
So her logic is sound in the system. And honestly, as any adult in a system like this that has children, you would do the same thing if you really truly believe the system and you liked your kids enough to say, I want you to survive.
Well, and last week we talked about violence and how violent the Brigham Young period was. And they took this rhetoric very seriously. And when you believe apostates are just going to outer darkness anyway.
But you make them subhuman at that point. That doesn't matter what you do to them, except they're causing us trouble now. So let's just speed them on their journey.
I've implied that the later church becomes fairly redemptive. The verse, I kept referring to it. So somebody's going to be yelling at their little iPod right now. I kept saying that Joseph Smith redefined the term eternal. Joseph did back away from this, by the way. So he started with really hellfire and damnation, and then these passages, which are the predominant theology of the time. As Joseph aged, he became much more and more universalist is the word I'm looking for. And salvation became something he started bartering. Literally, he was trading salvation for wives. That he would go to men and say, I want to marry your daughter. And in return, she and everybody in your family will be saved in the eternal kingdom. But, later God says, that punishment is only eternal because it's my punishment and I'm eternal. So it's really not going to go on forever. It's just that I'm going to punish people. So this is an example where Joseph starts backing away. And it's an example where in Mormonism you have this weird sort of things that exist both ways. And I hinted at, now we have temple work, we have the idea of redemption, that they take names from, you know, church registers from Norway from 1700s, and they will baptize them, and they'll give the men the priesthood, and they'll seal together these families so that they can receive these blessings. So, I think that Mormonism has backed away from this staunch view, but not in terms of canon. You know, this is still there in the Doctrine and Covenants. And that's why people ask me, do you think they'll ever take things out of the Doctrine and Covenants? Like, what? What would you leave in there?
Well, I think I think implicitly they're really trying to do that already. When was the last time, I mean, granted, I don't watch conference that much, but when was the last time anybody took anything substantial out of the Doctrine and Covenants and used it in a conference address or used it anywhere for that instance? I think the only place you really get Doctrine and Covenants these days is if you're in a seminary or an institute class.
Right, right. They proof text. I mean, a great example you get quoted all the time is Joseph Smith saying, it's man's purpose to be happy or whatever. That's taken out of a letter he wrote to Nancy Rigdon. He's trying to bang her, right? And we pull that thing out of that letter all the time. They ignore all the rest, which is he's trying to get in her pantaloons or whatever, her bloomers. But we love taking things out of context. All right, so that's Mormon hell, and you're all going to it. The devil, we sort of hinted at, the devil is a fascinating character in all of, I find the Eastern devil, like the devil in Hinduism and Buddhism to be much more of a compelling figure. The Christian devil is just sort of this weird fucked up nutcase who doesn't really make any sense. Like he keeps walking, he's like a mix between the bad guys in a Scooby-Doo cartoon. And like, he's just, like, I've said before that if I get to be the devil on another planet, which I won't, I would say, I will take the spirits that follow me. We will do nothing. We will sit down there and play Parcheesi, and your whole plan will fall apart because it needs to have a devil. And I'm not going to be that dick, right? Because it doesn't work without the devil. And so why this guy can't figure that stuff out, it's beyond me. But, and why he gets to rule anything, I mean, this is more of a traditional Christian view. I just think the whole thing falls apart when you start looking at the devil too closely. I mean, he's awesome, like in heavy metal music and like on album covers and stuff. But in real life, he's just kind of he's kind of like a middle class douchebag.
He's manipulated.
Can he not read? That's the question I want to know, because we know his fate apparently, because we can read through, you know, at least the Bible. Does he not know how to read? Does he not know that God already handed out and said what his fate is? What's the point?
He's like cast out of heaven and, oh, I get to go to earth anyway? Oh, all right. So I get to tempt people? Oh, wow.
Well, but why doesn't he just go hang out and, who was it that, it was, Heber C. Kimball or one of those guys had the, it was when the 12 were over in England and they had the revelation where they were went into a pub and there were all these spirits like lined up jumping into the body so they could get a little taste of ale or whatever. So I think that's the theory, is that they know they have 6,000 years to like get it on by like possessing, you know, people involved in like kinky sex or whatever. And that's what they do, is they go and they try to feel the world through everybody else's bodies. I don't know. Okay, I found it. DNC 1911. Where are we going to go there? Just to show you how Joseph Smith maneuvers a little bit. And I think we have a whole podcast devoted to this section, don't we? I don't know. There's been a lot of them. I just can't keep track anymore. 1911. Eternal punishment is God's punishment. Do, do, do. But you saw in the other verse how they said eternal and endless and he defined verse 10 and said, this is a mystery. I'm going to tell you a mystery. Here's a mystery of God. Eternal doesn't really mean eternal. It just means godly.
So, John, I'm curious, because the DNC is not in chronological order. What is the year of that section?
Oh, it's 1830.
So not only that, it predates this.
You just jammed my melon, man. This happened before. So you can't use this, because afterward he said heaven is, my God.
So which
we're
is it?
Doomed. This was the one script. No, I have two scriptures I'm holding out hope for. This was one of them, and now you just shattle over that. Thank
now
you.
You're going to have to find the other one.
The other one is the one that says if you are sealed to your parents or whatever, you'll be buffeted for a while, then delivered. That's my mom and dad, stay faithful. That's my.
It's the only hope for a lot of us at this
point. All right. Well,
sorry, I didn't mean to take it down too much. I more just wanted to explore contradictory nature of these thoughts for Joseph Smith. It's, you can't even nail him down within a 2-year span on whether the doctrine is this progressive way that we're taking it now, whether it's this other way that has this more, you know, older Calvinist slash, you know, pick your mythology way, right?
Yeah.
You go back to the philosophy of the ancient Greeks. And he just, the thing that I find about reading the Doctrine and Covenants that's so fascinating and maddening at the same time is it's always a moving target. He never sticks with something long enough that you really can build something solid behind it.
Well, I said a few weeks ago we were going through one of the sections, and I said I didn't understand the order they'd put the Doctrine and Covenants in. I actually think it's just random on purpose, because if they lined it up chronologically, you would see the doctrinal development. You'd see doctrines rise and fall. And I think it's just throwing sand in people's eyes, the way it's all mixed up. All right, well, you've got precious little time left on this planet before you're going to hell, so don't waste any more on this podcast. So we better wrap it up. Any last thoughts from any of you?
You know, one thing about this DNC section 19, the logic says that the reason you're going to suffer in hell is because you didn't accept the sacrifice of Jesus. He suffered for you. You didn't accept that, and so now you got to suffer. But how long did he suffer? I mean, he suffered over the space of a few days. So how is that fair that if I do the suffering that he tried to do for
me, got a calculator?
That I would be there in eternity?
Anybody got a calculator? Okay, Randy. 72 hours. Let's say he suffered 72 hours. And let's say I'm middling average. So when you average out the amount of sin that I have done, I'm average for the population. And let's use a conservative figure. Let's use 30 billion. Divide 72 hours by 30 billion, please.
I don't know if this calculator will hold that number of digits.
I'll take my stripes. Thank you.
It's somewhere, if I hit it right, it's going to be something small. It's 2.4 times 10 to the negative 9th, and I think I may have missed a couple of zeros there, so it's probably even bigger than that.
But even if we take the scripture that says those will suffer even as Christ suffered? All right. Sign me up.
Well, yeah.
I'm sure it'll be shitty, but it'll only be a long weekend, right? Well,
yeah. And really, it's like a day and a half if you really actually read into it.
And you know you're not going to die, right? So you can skip. You've already read the last chapter in the book. You get out alive.
So if we want, though, to actually take that even, you know, full lifetime, right? All the sins that you've done in your whole lifetime, if Jesus got everybody done in 3 days, hold on, let me suffer. Done.
If there's a Mormon hell, I'm so going to. I've got no chance. But there's only, that means I can... It doesn't get any worse than it's already going to get. I just will go rob the bank or something, right? All right, well, anything else? As always, the discussion continues over on the website at MormonExpression.com. Be sure to check out our parent company, which has nothing to do with the kind of bullshitty stuff we were talking about here, which is WhitefieldsEducational.org. We've got a lot of interesting things happening, especially in the counseling and therapeutic lines. Check that out. Tonight, our sound was done by Charles. Thanks, Charles. And the staff of hundreds of people who've helped out over the years that I'm forever in debt towards. So thanks to the panel tonight, and thanks to all of you. Good night.
Good night.